this point, you can't get up the coast. You can't get up the mountain. The freeway's closed.
And you can't get south either.
I think the only chance would either be maybe the freeway would allow you access south to a safer place, but it's closed just south of us as well again. So it's pretty crazy.
John and Nancy Heil in Summerlin, stuck there just below Santa Barbara. Lots of people stuck in lots of places today thanks to mudslides and flooding. These are the areas in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties that burned just a few weeks ago. Pretty crazy, as John Heil said, and very dangerous. This is Santa Barbara Fire Chief Patrick McElroy.
This was always our fear with this fire. The front country of Santa Barbara, this area hadn't burned for a really long time. And the time of year that it burned, in December, if we would have a rainy season, which we haven't had over the past several years, we were going to have problems. And here it is.
Santa Barbara's fire chief speaking with KCRW's Catherine Barnes. She's on the line now from our Santa Barbara studio. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Madeline.
And we're also joined by KCRW's Jonathan Bastian, who is supposed to be in Santa Barbara, but he's one of the many people stuck on the roads today. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey, Madeline.
Catherine, let's begin with you. What do we know about the emergency response so far?
Yeah, so as Pat McElroy just said, emergency officials anticipated that these mudslides were going to happen way back when the fire first began in early December. They knew that these areas are really high elevation. These mountains go up to 3,000 feet and then descend into the ocean. So there's a lot of room for mud and water to move. And so that's why they issued these mandatory evacuations on Sunday night for Monday afternoon when the rains were coming in. But I think some of the worst damage we're hearing were actually in areas that were not under an evacuation order. They were under an evacuation warning, which means a lot of residents were still in their houses asleep last night when the flooding hit around 1, 2, 3 a.m. So that means a lot of people are needing to be rescued early this morning and continue to be needing to be rescued. And it's very dangerous. There's still water moving and mud moving. And as you said, I spoke with Santa Barbara City Fire Chief Pat McElroy, and here's what he told me about that.
We're trying to get everybody into safe areas. As first responders, we're trying to do all the rescuing we can, but we need to be available to rescue. And so we're trying to put our people in safe places so when the rain lets up, they'll be able to go right back in. But obviously, in some of the areas where that have been affected, you don't want to put more people in there right now. And we're still trying to get a handle on the scope of it.
Well, Catherine, you can really hear the water there coming down, but you were out there actually seeing it and seeing all that mud. Tell us what it looked like.
Yeah, so I was on Hot Springs Road, which is kind of it's kind of in the center of Montecito, and it's an area that got slammed last night with a swollen creek that runs through that area. It brought tons of mud and debris overnight, and walking around there this morning, it really did look apocalyptic. Like, I drive on that road all the time, and it's usually this sleepy road with beautiful houses on the sides, and there are just houses completely obliterated. There were helicopters above us. Those guys were search and rescue teams, so they were helping to pull people out of their houses that actually, you know, vehicles couldn't get there to rescue them. There were bulldozers that were clearing the road of these huge, huge boulders, just so that emergency, you know, fire crews could get in, vehicles could get in to help save people. And I think that now they're worrying that this next mud and debris could come. Right now it's around noon and you know, more rain could pick up in this next hour.
Oh. And so here is paradise not looking very The picture of paradise at all. So the rest of Santa Barbara, the rest of the city, is it also suffering?
The rest of Santa Barbara is actually pretty okay. Sometimes downtown Santa Barbara does get flooded from rain, but I think maybe it flooded late last night, and so far that water has pushed into the ocean. So Santa Barbara itself looks pretty normal. I think a main thing is just it's quiet because a lot of people live in Ventura, work in Santa Barbara, and they are just not able to get here. The 101 is still shut down.
Okay, Jonathan, that's your cue because you're one of those people. What was it like out there today?
Yeah, I mean, as Catherine mentioned, tens of thousands of people have to make this journey north on the 101. And, you know, we heard reports that it was shut down, but we thought maybe some of the side streets would be open. There's basically two or three roads to get into Santa Barbara. I tried every single one of them this morning. It's just dead ends. You run in either into a flooded road. At one point, I ran into a road that was just completely washed away. And people, it's kind of madness out there. Cars are trying to turn around. They're trying to find different routes to get in and out of town. But at the moment, we're basically here sitting, and this is a major problem. 10 years ago, there was another major landslide, the La Conchita landslide, some will remember, and it was a reminder just how quickly this area can be isolated when one of these major mudslides happen.
Yeah, and even that sounds dangerous, just what you just described, driving around, because you never know if you'll be stuck in like a big body of water.
Yeah, I saw one car literally go off the 101. It was sitting in a ditch, vehicles stuck in mud, stuck in water. And it was as I was kind of just going, hitting dead end after dead end, seeing parts of the roads just slid out in front of me. I ran into John and Nancy Heil, who described what was going on.
We're just pretty much watching every road around us, including the 101 highway closed. Unexpected little sinkholes in roads that previously seemed okay. And unfortunately, people are walking in there to take pictures and then falling in these holes and getting caught a little bit in situations they didn't expect. So
we're actually sitting right here trying, the roads are all closed, and explain what's going on in front of us here. It looks like I see a bunch of mud, a bunch of water.
Yeah, that's the part where the road has washed out and cars are just stopping and turning around or going forward to take pictures. And those are the people that are getting caught unsuspected as they walk through a little bit of mud, and then all of a sudden the road drops underneath them and they fall up to their chest in the mud.
And apparently the emergency vehicles can't really get in here to close it off. So people are just, you know, trying to get to work and doing things and being stopped at every place. I just got another emergency phone call from the county of Santa Barbara asking people to stay off the roads. Wow. Just while you were talking. So it's definitely, they are really trying hard to clear the area.
Yeah, I mean, they're talking about sinkholes, which I saw in front of me, and there was even maybe a little bit of sound you could hear of people on dirt bikes and ATVs just trying to get around some of this mud, because that's pretty much the best you could do. So things are really at a standstill right now.
Yeah, and so I guess they will be for a little while after the rain ends and the real cleanup begins.
Yeah, there's no timetable on this right now. I mean, part of the 101 looked like it was literally underwater. There's these incredible images right now in Montecito coming out. And so we don't know how long it's going to take to even get areas like Montecito functional. It could be days. It could be weeks. It depends just how quickly they can get some of this mud out of here. But I spoke to people in Montecito that don't have running water or power right now. So we're going to have to wait and see.
All right. Well, thank you, Jonathan. Try to stay dry. Try.
Thanks, Madeline.
KCRW's Jonathan Bastian in Carpinteria and Catherine Barnes in Santa Barbara. The current storm is adding to concerns about public health in San Diego. That city is in the process of evacuating homeless encampments along the San Diego River. It's part of an effort to clean up the river, which is polluted with trash and with human feces. Yeah. San Diego is already in the midst of a hepatitis A outbreak that killed 20 people and put nearly 400 in the hospital. Joshua Smith is on the line to fill us in. He's a reporter for the San Diego Union-Tribune. Hey, Josh.
Hey, nice to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so I understand this evacuation has been going on since December, and I imagine the rain is making it a little more difficult today.
Yeah, I mean, well, they've been trying to get people out of the river actually since September. Things really started to ramp up in December when they started sending crews twice a week into the river to clear out homeless camps and remove debris and trash. So far, they've removed 100 tons of garbage from the San Diego River.
And this garbage is coming from the encampments?
Yeah, primarily. When you go down there, it's pretty clear that there's a lot of people living along the river, and they bring with them tents, tarps, bikes, food that they eat, and it just gets spread throughout the watershed. And then when it rains, obviously, that stuff gets washed into the river and adds to pollution concerns.
Right. And then there's the human excrement part of it. So that's also a public health hazard.
So, yeah. So we last winter excrement, human excrement, actually specifically spiked in the San Diego River. And county health officials are trying to figure out where it's coming from. One place could be the homeless that live along the river, but it also could be leaky sewer pipes or illegal dumping from RVs, a wide variety of sources. And one way to kind of narrow down where it's coming from is to try to get everyone off of the river before it rains and then take water samples.
Okay, so first of all, how did so many homeless people end up on the shores of the river to begin with?
Well, after the hepatitis outbreak in San Diego was declared in the fall, the mayor directed law enforcement to go into downtown San Diego and move everyone out. And there was a major abatement effort to wash down streets, provide porta potties, hand washing stations. And it's thought that at that point, a lot of people migrated over to the river.
Okay, and so now that they're kicking them out of the river area, where are they going to go?
So we don't really know. I mean, there's three temporary homeless shelters that have been set up in the meantime, and so the city is trying to provide at least temporary relief. San Diego seems to be still kind of grappling with its long-term approach to homelessness, as many cities in Southern California are.
Yeah. And so this whole effort to clean out the river area, that doesn't have anything to do with hepatitis A? I mean, there's a direct link between people living along the riverbanks and the disease.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question, right? Because there were concerns at one point that people may be contracting the hepatitis from the river, but county health officials said that that was not the case, according to their investigations, that they didn't believe that it was coming from the river, that they thought it was being passed person to person. However, that doesn't mean that unsanitary conditions, either whether on city streets downtown or within the watershed, were not contributing to that person-to-person transmission of hepatitis. You also have to remember that cleaning up the river has been a longstanding issue for many water quality advocates in Southern California, you know, whether it's the LA River or the San Diego River. You know, people want to revitalize these upstream resources. And so water quality advocates, you know, hailed this move as a huge win for them in terms of trying to just clean up the water quality in general in the area.
Right. Okay. So once the homeless are moved out and they maybe spend some time in the temporary shelters and then they start leaving those temporary shelters, are they just going to go back?
Yeah. So this is the big question, right? Like that's the next thing we're trying to answer here. And the mayor has said that come budget time, he's really going to need support from everyone from the city council to stakeholders throughout the community if they want to allocate new dollars to keeping the river free of homeless camps. One thing that is interesting about the situation is that we don't really know where that money would come from. Right now, the mayor has a contract with a local service provider, Alpha Projects, but they haven't said how much that's costing. If you look at similar kind of contracts, it's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So there's a lot of questions to be answered there.
In your reporting, when you go out to these homeless encampments, what do the homeless people say to you about this?
That you get a lot of, well, where am I supposed to go? You know, like the code officers or the police come down here, they tell me to move, but I don't know, you know, what's my alternative. A lot of people say that they're basically told in one way or another, you know, out of sight, out of mind, you know, try to stay hidden, try to avoid contact with people who might complain, because for a long time, code enforcement's actions on the river were complaint-driven. So if a resident saw something or a business, you know, put in a call, then that would be the only reason why they would go down there. I've seen people loading up carts and saying, yeah, we're moving on, we're taking everything, and, you know, now we're going to go downtown, you know, and then we'll get pushed out of there, and then we're going to go over here. So, and when you talk to law enforcement, I say, what do you think the situation is on the river? Are there more homeless folks than ever before? And they say, you know, it's hard to tell because, you know, people move around a lot.
Joshua Smith, reporter at the San Diego Union-Tribune, thank you.
Absolutely, you're welcome.
Coming up, what's next for the nation's second largest school district. Once again, LAUSD is without a permanent leader. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Kids in America's second largest school district went back to school yesterday, most probably unaware that they have no leader, at least not a permanent one. LAUSD Superintendent Michelle King said she's retiring this June. She has cancer and has not been on the job since the school year began. Acting Superintendent Vivian Ekchian is filling in as the board looks for a permanent leader. Again, it seems every few years the board has to launch another exhaustive and exhausting search for a superintendent. Howard Bloom covers education for the LA Times. Welcome back.
Hi. Yes, it is especially exhausting for me since I have to cover every twist and turn of this allegedly confidential process.
Yeah, including today, right? They're in a private meeting, and I imagine number one on the agenda is, what are we going to do about our leader?
Right. And you don't get much of a cue from the agenda other than the fact that the item superintendent of schools, interim superintendent, acting superintendent, associate superintendent, they have all the titles covered so they can discuss any of those things that they wish.
Okay. Well, so are they thinking they'll just stick with the woman that they have, or they're going to really launch a nationwide search again?
I expect them to launch a nationwide search, and also probably they'll stick with the person they have at the moment. They've all been praising what a great job Vivian Ekchian has been doing filling in for Michelle King. So if they then remove her and put in a different acting superintendent, then that will be interesting. But Ekchian could apply for the permanent job. She, I guess, would be a candidate for the permanent job if she wanted, but most likely we can expect a nationwide search.
And why was there so much mystery around Michelle King's illness? Initially, we didn't even know she was this ill.
In fact, they did not want us to know she was away at all initially, but at a certain point, her absence becomes noticeable. And then if you think back, you think, well, she was using a cane. She was in obvious discomfort. There must have been something going on. And, you know, they kept pushing the date back, back, and back. And part of it is that Michelle King is a very private person. There are certain laws in California that prohibit the disclosure of an employee's medical condition. So all those things combine for a lot of secrecy around her condition.
Okay, well, let's look at her legacy, brief as it was. What do you make of it? Graduation rates are up. There were no major scandals or disasters with the words iPad in them. So what kind of legacy does she leave?
The graduation rates are at record levels, and they continue to go up and up. And that is pretty consistent with what's going on around the country. There's this thing called credit recovery that allows students to quickly make up failed classes. And I am struggling with whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. And some of this credit recovery miracle is hard work on the part of teachers and students. Maybe most of it is. Some of it I'm uncomfortable with. And while part of her legacy are these record graduation rates, I think part of her legacy also is an unwillingness to look into whether these graduation rates have come at the expense of some rigor. I mean, if we really are looking at the interest of kids, I think they'd want to do a top-to-bottom examination of whether these record rates are all they're cracked up to be. But as I say that, this phenomena is sweeping the country, and LA Unified is just jumping on the train here.
Well, talk a little bit more about that. What does this mean, credit recovery?
So if a student fails a class and they need to graduate, they're not going to graduate unless they make up that class. And there are ways for students to make up these classes very quickly through these credit recovery classes online. And there's been question about the standards of these classes, whether they're hard enough, whether it's too easy to cheat in these classes. LA Unified has a very long menu of ways that a student can undo a failed grade very quickly and get to graduation. And even if a student is illiterate, an illiterate student with a diploma will do better in life than an illiterate student without a diploma, but that can't quite be the standard, right? Otherwise, just give everybody diplomas and they'll do statistically a little better in life than if they don't have diplomas. But that's something that both the administration and the board members have really been unwilling to take a deep look at because they've been celebrating these historically high graduation rates. You know, another thing that she's trying to do is she started with the old board these initiatives to increase enrollment and combat competition from independently or privately operated charter schools, because every student a charter school gets is one student and the funding that comes with it that the district doesn't get. And that really puts a pinch on the district finances long term. It even threatens the district's solvency. So they've added these special programs, these dual language programs, these magnet programs. So they've added some programs, which if they're good, that's a good thing, but it hasn't reversed the enrollment decline.
Well, speaking of charters, there's now a majority of pro-charter members on the school board. So will they be looking for a superintendent who is expressly pro-charter? I mean, Michelle King was an anti-charter, but she was more of a traditionalist.
I think that remains to be seen, because the way the state law works, if you have a petition for a charter school, the district has to approve it if it meets the legal requirements. So they don't necessarily need a pro-charter superintendent to continue the growth of the charter movement. They certainly would prefer someone who's not anti-charter, someone who would be open to making district properties open to charter school operators, because that's one of the biggest challenges for a charter school is finding a place to have your school. In the coming weeks, we're going to definitely be debating all these candidates. Now, they could theoretically go in today and choose a superintendent. Nothing would stop them except that it would not be a unanimous choice. It would be a whole brouhaha if they tried to do that. And I think what's more likely to come out of today's meeting is a measured response that says, okay, we're going to start the process of looking for a superintendent.
And how long would that take?
They have the power to name a superintendent at any time and shortcut their own process. And if they find the right person that they like, then they could do it at any time. But most likely, it would take several months to the better part of a year, theoretically.
Yeah, and meanwhile, there's all sorts of other stuff they need to talk about and deal with. Finances, lowering enrollment, as you said, offering better courses and better alternatives for parents who are looking elsewhere.
Right. Well, Vivian Etchian, the acting superintendent, acts as though she's quite happy to be settled in the job for a while and take on these challenges. You know, she has experience in many facets of the district. What the so-called reformers, and I don't mean that dismissively, but that's, you know, terminology is so important here, that they call themselves reformers, other people call them privatizers, but what they might not like about Vivian Etchian is that she spent her entire career in the district and is a district person through and through, but she does have a lot of experience. She's been the chief labor negotiator, she was the head of the human resources department, she taught in the classroom for 8 years, so she certainly has a range of experience that at least ought to enable her to hold down the fort. And how long they want her to do that, we'll see.
Howard Bloom, he covers education for the LA Times. Thanks.
Happy to do it.
Coming up, what it's like to be the last person on Earth who knows how to speak your language.
It's not just not having a mother tongue that you can talk to anyone in, but also not having anyone else that's like your people.
The last speaker of Taushiro in the Peruvian Amazon. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm a Kishino Ashina Ya Tenente.
There's no way you understood any of that. That's because it's a language called Taushiro. And the recording is of Amadeo Garcia Garcia, the last man on the planet who knows how to speak that language. His tribe once numbered in the thousands in the Amazon basin in Peru. But as with so many of the indigenous people of the Amazon, the Taushiro have succumbed to the encroachment of people with guns and new diseases like measles and smallpox. Now, Amadeo Garcia Garcia has no one else he can speak with in his mother tongue. Nicholas Casey is the Andes bureau chief for the New York Times. He covers most of South America for the paper, and he met with Amadeo recently and wrote a long story for the Times about that and about the language dying out. And he joins me now. Hi.
Hi.
Well, how did you first meet him, Amadeo Garcia Garcia?
Well, it takes a long time to get to where he's living now, although he's living a lot closer to civilization than he used to. To get to where Amadeo lives, you have to first take a flight from Lima to a city called Iquitos, which is known as the largest city that can't be reached by car. You can only get there by boat or by a flight because it's in the Amazon. It's deep within the Amazon. And from there, you have to take a boat to get to Intuto, which is where Amadeo lives. And that boat ride, if you take a speedboat, which we did, was a 10-hour journey from Iquitos. The way that Amadeo would get to the nearest city, if he were to take the boat, because he goes with the same ferry that most people take from Iquitos, it takes about 3 days. So he lives still in a really, really isolated part of the Amazon. Mm. And that's where we found him. We found him at his home, swinging in his hammock, as he does every day.
Mm. How old is he?
He's not sure of his age, actually. He thinks he's approaching 70 years old right now. But he grew up in an isolated tribe, a group of people which didn't have anything close to regular contact with the rest of the world. So when he was living in the forest at that point of his life, no one wrote down what his birth date was. He didn't have a birth certificate, and people didn't have the same calendar there as we use here. So he thinks he's in his late 60s, maybe getting close to 70.
So he grew up with no contact with the outside world, but obviously the outside world found him eventually. Can you describe how that happened?
They did. Well, there's a lot of tribes still that aren't in contact, and a lot of that had to do with a really disastrous period of history where rubber traders came and massacred many Native Americans who were living in the jungles. Among them were the Taushiro people that decided to go hiding in the forest essentially for generations. But in the 1970s, when they started to drill for oil, looking for another natural resource after rubber disappeared, an oil company found that there was a small tribe of people living by themselves when they were doing aerial flights. And Amadeo remembers seeing the planes fly down and being able to see people's faces out of them. He hadn't seen planes before. And not long afterward, members of a missionary group came to meet the Taushiro, and that really marked the first time that the Taushiro were in complete contact with the outside world. There'd been visitors who'd come, hunters in the jungle, but the missionaries were there to come to kind of bring them into the fold of civilization, bring them food, medicine, teach them about what was going on outside.
And at that point, how many members of the tribe were there?
They were down to just more than a dozen at that point. The Taushiro used to be thousands of people, but it was just one small group who was living along the edge of a river. There were so few people that they didn't have names in the traditional sense. Amadeo called his father Iya, which just means father, and the mother was known as Inyo. That just meant mother. Amadeo was a name that they got only after someone else had come to give them Christian names to separate everybody from each other.
And when the missionaries came, was it much like the story of missionaries here and colonialists here, they brought with them disease and violence.
Yeah, I mean, the arrival of outsiders, especially for isolated groups, is always a really difficult time. That said, when the missionary group first came, there had already been a disease which was going through the Taushiro group, and they actually brought penicillin with them. And that was able to save a number of the people that might have died from dying. Now, this marked a really close relationship between the Taushiro and the missionaries, one which got increasingly intense, resulted in the Taushiro converting to Christianity. On the other end, the missionaries were also there to document the Taushiro language. So they actually have created some of the largest records which exist of some of the words which exist in Taushiro. So they were playing very different roles at times there. They were bringing, you know, things from the outside world, which was changing the Taushiro. But they were also doing a lot to preserve the language that the Taushiro were speaking.
So even if he is the last person to actually speak the language, it will survive in at least in written form somewhere?
It's hard to say survival, because languages only really survive when people are speaking them. They don't survive as a list of words. You could write down many hundreds of words in Taushiro, and still you wouldn't really know how to say them unless you had people that were still speaking them. So it's pretty much accepted that when Amadeo goes, this language is going to go with him. There will be remnants of it. There will be very small, limited dictionaries. There will be some of the New Testament stories that the missionaries translated into Taushiro, which is the only literature which exists now in the language. But the speakers will be gone, and Amadeo has gotten too old, I think, at this point, to be able to take this language to anyone else.
Mm. I mean, your article, you really paint a very tragic picture of his life. I mean, it sounds like an illustration of what's happened to Indigenous people all over the world. He is basically alone. He used to have children, but they've all gone, or he has children, but they don't live there. And he spends his days drinking. And it's just very sad. He couldn't pass on the language to his kids?
No. And this has been the case with a lot of Indigenous languages. There were 47 languages spoken in Peru alone that have been lost in the last 100 years. And largely the reason why they get lost is because people think that speaking Spanish is going to give you a better chance in the world than speaking an Indigenous language, which is beginning to disappear and often has a lot of stigmas against it. And this was definitely the dynamic in Amadeo's family. And although Amadeo had worked over the years with linguists to try to document Taushiro, I think his children also realized that the future for them wasn't necessarily the Taushiro language. They needed to learn Spanish. They needed to be able to earn money. And when they were eventually adopted, they were brought to Puerto Rico, where their fortunes changed immensely. It was a difficult decision for Amadeo to agree to have his kids be adopted, but he didn't feel that he could take care of them. And for him, it was a choice between trying to save this language or trying to save his children. And, you know, I think any father put in that position is going to have to choose the children over the language, no matter how tragic a decision like that is to make.
But other linguists thought it was an unethical decision on the part of this missionary who adopted the kids and took them out of the area and took them to Puerto Rico.
They would argue that, and this was one of the Christian missionaries that was working with them, who's a very close friend of the family, Tali Alicea is her name. She actually cut the umbilical cord of one of the children there when she came to work with them as a missionary. She was the one that decided to adopt the kids. There's two ways to look at this, and these were the choices that she had. She had the choice of someone who had studied the language as a linguist, where it might have been the wrong decision to have taken the children away from the only situation where they might have learned the language. But she also had the choice of being a Christian missionary, which was that she felt a moral obligation to adopt the children because of the situation that they were in with a single father who had become an alcoholic. One of the children had already been once kidnapped because he wasn't able to care for them, and they were living in an orphanage at that point. So in that difficult decision where you're choosing between the language and the people, she chose the kids, and that among some linguists is a choice which is debated, but I think by no means a black or white choice or an easy one at that.
Mm-hmm. And how do the kids feel about it now? They're grown up. They have kids of their own. Some of them do. How do they feel about not knowing this language?
Well, I think as a lot of children have felt on not learning the language of their parents. And when they were kids, they were discouraged from learning the language by the society. And now suddenly kind of it's 2018 we're in now. And you have a lot more efforts to try to preserve these languages. These are being valued. People are being told these are things which are about to disappear. And the children, you know, Amadeo's kids, now I think they do feel like an immense loss at not having been able to learn Taushura, because they know they would be the last speakers of this language, and they're not going to be.
Well, is it too late? Could they go back and spend some time with their dad and learn it?
It's possible, but it would mean for them making a completely different decision about their lives and how they were going to be themselves. This wouldn't be a question of just visiting their father. At the beginning of the segment, we talked about just how long it takes to get to where he is. Mm-hmm. They would have to spend years of their lives living in a place which is completely different from Puerto Rico, where most of the kids are living right now, not in the United States, deep in the Amazon. And again, I think that would be a decision they'd not only be making for themselves, but also for their children. And I think they've had to sort of make their decision to continue with their lives.
And this is not the only case, right, of languages dying out in Peru. There are many more that are at risk.
No, and not just in Peru. This is happening all over the world, and especially in the Amazon. The Amazon's a place which, for centuries, had a huge linguistic diversity. You would go around literally every bend of the river and find another language that might be unintelligible from the last one that you heard. You know, as I said earlier, 47 languages in Peru have disappeared in the last century, and there's another 40 which are at risk of extinction. And this is a huge thing. I think often it takes a second to step back and understand why the loss of a language is so important. But if you could imagine a world where you were the last person who spoke English, and what that would mean, that when you were gone, everything from your last emails to Shakespeare would be insignificant, wouldn't make any sense because no one else spoke it or understood it. Language is kind of a fundamental thing to who we are. So for Peru, for places where they're losing languages at the dozens, this is a huge loss, not just for the people who are losing these languages and for the identities, but just for humanity. These are some of the biggest systems of thought that we've ever created, these languages. And yet there will be many which will disappear in our lifetimes because people aren't speaking them anymore.
So does Amadeo, does he have a sense of this enormous weight on him, Amadeo? Does he understand just how momentous this is, that this language is dying out with him?
He's definitely aware of this. He talks about it regularly. I think the way that this manifests for him the most is just the loneliness that he has, because it's not just not being able to speak to other people in your same language, not having a mother tongue that you can talk to anyone in, because Spanish is his second language. He still stumbles in it sometimes. But also not having anyone that you've had a shared history with that are gone, anyone else that's like your people, your Taushiro people that he was. And he knows how big of a thing this is going to be for his society when he's gone. But what's also interesting, and what I noticed when I reported with him, was we have this idea of what it means to be kind of like the last person of your tribe. I think that's been often a trope that has been around for many centuries, you know, throughout American history, certainly. Amadeo doesn't necessarily fit the description, and I don't think many people often do, because no one ever asks to be the last person of their tribe. No one asks to be that last kind of solitary person who's carrying the weight of the world in their shoulders. No, he didn't know that this was going to happen to him. He's a bit of a loner. He's a bit of a kind of a hero with flaws, and he definitely drinks a lot of the time. He definitely stumbles around town at times. He's really representative of what a normal Taushiro person might have been, you know, warts and all. And that's often, I think, how these cultures kind of meet their end, in the hands of someone who had no idea that burden was going to be on their shoulders.
Nicholas Casey is the Andes bureau chief of the New York Times. His story is called Thousands Once Spoke His Language in the Amazon. Now he's the only one. Check it out at the New York Times website. Nick, thank you so much.
Thanks, Natalie.
Coming up, why Democrats are super excited about longtime Republican stronghold Orange County. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Democrats are feeling pretty energized heading into this year's midterm elections after some big wins last year in Alabama and Virginia. The party thinks it has the momentum to take back the House this November. To do that, though, they'll need to flip around half a dozen districts in one of the Republican Party's historic strongholds, and that is Orange County. And on that front, Democrats got some good news. Republican Congressman Ed Royce of Fullerton announced he will not seek re-election this year. Joining us to talk about what that means and the overall Orange County landscape is Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Hey, Rafe.
Good to be with you, Madeline.
Well, what do you make of Royce's decision to retire? What's the reason, the real reason?
Nobody has a clue. We have all kinds of possibilities. One is he loses his position as chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, which is his main issue and main interest. Because the Republicans put a 6-year limit on people being committee chairs, probably not the greatest idea in the world. His wife is being nominated for a position in the government by President Trump, and his announcement followed very quickly after news of that. And I have another way to put it is I have no clue. The third one is the possibility that he might lose.
Yeah. And so are Democrats just licking their chops? Do they have someone waiting in the wings?
Oh, I think it's unspeakable how excited Democrats are because the single biggest obstacle to a Democratic wave is incumbency. And Ed Royce is a pretty well-regarded incumbent in Orange County. He's been there a long time. He's considered a conservative but works well with others. And I'm still kind of in shock that he's not going to run. I thought he was vulnerable. But he was not vulnerable like Issa and Rohrabacher and Steve Knight and people like that. And I think it's a huge door opener. However, there's a bunch of strong Republicans who may take a look at the race. I would still say Democrats would rather run against a strong Republican who's not an incumbent, though, than against a well-known incumbent.
Mm-hmm. Now, Orange County was won by Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Adding to the shocks.
Yeah.
Of our lives these last few years. It's been coming for a long time, Madeline, because the Orange County is becoming more and more Democratic. It reminds me of the San Fernando Valley in L.A. that had always been seen as a conservative bastion, but now is a Democratic bastion. North Orange County especially, with the growth of the Latino population, but even South Orange County, the Irvine area, which had always been seen as very conservative, now is the kind of Republican voters who Democrats have a chance of winning, you know, the sort of suburban ring around big cities, pretty well-educated white voters who are increasingly leaning Democratic. So this was coming, but who knew it was going to come so quickly?
And why are they increasingly leaning Democratic?
Well, I think they're not drawn to the Trump model of the Republican Party, which is probably more popular in the industrial Midwest and the South, the kind of politics of resentment. These are generally well-educated voters, and well-educated voters have not been a great base of support for Donald Trump. And Trump drives everything, and his unpopularity in California just is just staggering at this point. So I think to the extent that the Republican Party becomes more Trumpified, they tend to weaken with well-educated white voters, many of whom might lean Republican in a more normal environment.
Mm. Well, we talk a lot about the Trump voter as being, you know, blue-collar Midwest or from the South, but he did win really rich people.
He did.
And his policies so far have benefited them. And there are a lot of really rich people in Orange County. Why do they not like Trump and his policies?
Well, you know, people don't always vote as predictably on their economic interests as you would imagine. And a lot of the research on that is getting more and more clear that, what do they say, people vote their identities, not their interests in some ways. There's a lot more at stake than your how you're going to do in the tax bill. But for example, since California is being targeted in the tax bill, and California voters are going to be kind of concerned in April, that's going to hurt Republican taxpayers as well as Democratic taxpayers. The very wealthiest do better than the merely well-to-do in the current tax environment that's going to be hitting people in April. So economics no longer so clearly predicts what people are going to do. A lot of it is social issues, and the kind of general demeanor of the president has turned off a lot of voters who ordinarily would be just delighted to vote Republican, would vote for Mitt Romney very happily.
But they may not like Donald Trump, but they may like their congressperson, their congressman.
Well, that's the
right?
key, is that very often people still at the end of the day like their member of Congress. However, Republicans are facing, so far, a couple of dozen incumbents nationwide are retiring and are not going to run for re-election. And that's a huge concern, because that's a canary in the mine for parties in midterm elections. You always watch to see how many retirements they have, because the incumbents can read polls better than we can. They've got a lot of private polling. And if they feel that they're in serious danger, career-wise, you might be better taking a hike and go find another job and leave on your own steam, as opposed to being carried out.
Let's talk about the Latino vote factor. You mentioned that the northern part of the county is increasingly Latino. Now 34% overall in Orange County is Latino. And while Trump's policies have targeted that demographic, you could look at it that way, talking about the border wall, ending DACA, the lackluster response to the hurricane in Puerto Rico, and most recently the decision to end temporary protective status for Salvadorans. So I imagine that this voting bloc is not too keen to pull the Republican lever.
I'd say that's a pretty much of an understatement. The main question is, will it generate a massive turnout? If it does, a number of Republicans in these contested districts are toast, partly because generally turnout is low for everybody in midterm elections, and any group that is more energized is going to have a disproportionate impact. When Latinos are not energized, they have a disproportionate low impact, but the reverse could be true. It's hard to know what more the president can do to alienate Latino voters. Including in Florida and in other places. It's just, at a certain point, I think the party has abandoned the argument that to prosper, they have to have more support from Latino voters. The question is, will it generate that massive turnout? If it does, it's going to be a very big wave.
Rafe Sonnenschein, Executive Director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Thanks, Rafe.
My pleasure.
Okay, a dry Christian Bordahl is here in the studio.
Yes.
You haven't been outside in hours.
I haven't. No, I've been sitting in here, sitting at my computer, being a good boy. Well, the rain is on everyone's mind.
Right.
Obviously, people dealing with evacuations and mudslides, and people suffering through their rainy day commutes. So I put up a little Twitter poll for our listeners to see just how they're feeling about the rain. And a full 68%, more than two-thirds of them, said, yay, I love the rain, bring it on.
And it's always good in the early days.
Yes, right, as long as it doesn't go on for too long.
Enthusiasm begins to wane pretty quickly, especially in the late afternoons,
uh-huh.
I find.
And another 28% said, I guess we need it, okay, I guess I'll put up with it. And then only 4% said, it sucks, I hate the rain, I have to commute in it, and it's all, you know, mudslides and people dealing with that stuff. Get rid of the rain. So anyway, that got me thinking about rain songs.
Mm-hmm.
And Madeline Brand, I put together a little medley of rain songs
so nice
for us
you.
To just go out on the show today. So what do you think? Should we play some rain songs?
Does one of them include Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Here comes the rain again. And the rain gets my window. I won't know.
it's hard rain.
All right. It's raining a lot, men and otherwise. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great day. Stay okay. Stay dry if you can. And I'll see you tomorrow.
I'm singing in the rain. Just singing in the rain. What a glorious feel. I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark.